Welcome to Poetry Basket, KIDE's monthly reading of poems from near and far. We acknowledge Independence Day this July by reading poems that express the price paid to bring the United States into being, the cost to Native peoples of North America, to its natural systems, to the people who came here in chains, to those who crossed our borders desperately seeking work, and to all of us struggling today to come to terms with a nation that continues to cause harm to its own and to people around the world.
We open with a Joy Harjo poem, a poem with a very long title, For Anna Mae Pictuaquash, whose spirit is present here and in the dappled stars. For we remember the story and must tell it again, so we may all live.
Anna Mae Pictuaquash was a young Mi'kmaq woman active in the American Indian Movement who was discovered missing in South Dakota. An unidentified body found on the Pine Ridge Reservation turned out to be Anna Mae. She'd been killed by a bullet to the head, shot at close range. Her killer has yet to be identified. Joy Harjo is a Muscogee Creek heritage. Here, then, is her tribute to Anna Mae.
For Anna Mae Pictuaquash. Beneath a sky, blurred with mist and wind, I am amazed as I watch the violet heads of crocuses erupt from the stiff earth after dying for a season, as I have watched my own dark head appear each morning after entering the next world to come back to this one, amazed. It is the way in the natural world to understand the place the ghost dancers named after the heartbreaking destruction. Anna Mae, everything and nothing changes. You are the shimmering young woman who found her voice when you were warned to be silent or have your body cut away from you like an elegant weed. You are the one whose spirit is present in the dappled stars. They prance and lope like colored horses who stay with us through the streets of these steely cities. And I have seen them nuzzling the frozen bodies of tattered drunks on the corner. This morning, when the last star is dimming and the buses grind toward the middle of the city, I know it is 10 years since they buried you the second time in Lakota, a language that could free you. I heard about it in Oklahoma or New Mexico, how the wind howled and pulled everything down in a righteous anger. It was the women who told me, and we understood, wordlessly, the ripe meaning of your murder. As I understand 10 years later, after the slow changing of the seasons, that we have just begun to touch the dazzling whirlwind of our anger. We have just begun to perceive the amazed world the ghost dancers entered, crazily, beautifully.
Turning Away from Lies is next, a poem by Robert Bly, the award-winning American poet born in Minnesota in 1926. We're reading Robert Bly's poem in three voices.
Turning Away from Lies. If we are truly free and live in a free country, when shall I be without this heaviness of mind? When shall I have peace? Peace this way and peace that way? I have already looked beneath the street, and there I saw the bitter waters going down, the ancient worms eating up the sky.
Christ did not come to redeem our sins. The Christ child was not obedient to his parents. The kingdom of heaven does not mean the next life. No one in business can be a Christian. The two worlds are both in this world.
The saints rejoice out loud upon their beds. Their song moves through the troubled sea, the way the holy tortoise moves from dark blue into troubled green. or ghost crabs move above the dolomite. The thieves are crying in the wild asparagus.
Next is Runaway Slave, an excerpt from Leaves of Grass by the great Walt Whitman, who was born on Long Island in 1819.
The runaway slave came to my house and stopped outside. I heard his motions crackling the twigs of the woodpile. Through the swung half-door of the kitchen I saw him limpsy and weak. And went where he sat on a log, and led him in, and assured him, and brought water and filled a tub for his sweated body and bruised feet, and gave him a room that entered from my own, and gave him some coarse, clean clothes, and remember perfectly well his revolving eyes and his awkwardness, and remember putting plasters on the galls of his neck and ankles. He stayed with me a week before he was recuperated and passed north. I had him sit next me at the table. My firelock leaned in the corner.
And now, Who Robbed the Woods? By New England poet Emily Dickinson. Written in the 19th century, the poem confirms that the destruction of Native America's natural world was well underway by then. Emily Dickinson was born in 1830.
Who robbed the woods, the trusting woods, the unsuspecting trees, brought out their burrs and mosses, his fantasy to please? He scanned their trinkets curious, he grasped, he bore away. What will the solemn hemlock, what will the fir tree say?
For a contemporary take on how Americans continue to rob the wood, we turn to the poem Wild by Tony Hoagland. We'll be reading several Tony Hoagland poems today. He is a master at elucidating life in these United States with grace, humor, and irony.
Wild. In late August, when the streams dry up and the high meadows turn parched and blonde, bears are squeezed out of the mountains, down into the valley of condos and housing developments. All residents are therefore prohibited from putting their garbage out early. The penalty for disobedience will be bears, large black furry fellows, drinking from your sprinkler system, rolling your trash cans down your lawn, bashing through the screen door of the back porch to get their first real taste of a spaghetti dinner, while the family hides in the garage and the wife dials 1-800-BEARS on her cell phone, a number she just made up in a burst of creative hysteria. Isn't that the way it goes? Wildlife enters your life and asks that you invent a way to meet it, and you run in the opposite direction. As the bears saunter down Main Street, sending station wagons crashing into fire hydrants, getting the police department to phone for tranquilizer guns, the dart going by accident into the neck of the unpopular police chief, who is carried into early retirement in an ambulance crowned with flashing red lights. As the bears inherit the earth, full of water and humans and garbage, which looks to them like paradise.
The Great Society, another poem by Robert Bly, is next.
The Great Society. Dentists continue to water their lawns, even in the rain. hands developed with terrible labor by apes, hang from the sleeves of evangelists. There are murdered kings in the light bulbs outside movie theaters. The coffins of the poor are hibernating in piles of new tires. The janitor sits troubled by the boiler, and the hotel keeper shuffles the cards of insanity. The president dreams of invading Cuba. Bushes are growing over the outdoor grills, vines over the yachts and the leather seats. The city broods over ash cans and darkening mortar. On the far shore, at Coney Island, dark children play on the chilling beach. A sprig of black seaweed, shells, a sky full of birds, while the mayor sits with his head in his hands.
And now, Placid Sunshine, a short comment on the American pastime of lawn mowing by Cynthia Potten.
Placid Sunshine. He had no smile for being alive that morning. The market fell, the cat was sick, and he told his wife he'd mow the lawn. Dumb decision. He should have hired Juan to do it, or Jesus. But after a second coffee, walking into the placid sunshine and surveying his green domain, he felt more expansive, ready to mow down, unaware, the little miracles alive and busy in the grass, with their intricate wings, their astonished eyes, their brittle and delicate legs.
For a portrait of the Native American approach to Earth's defenseless creatures, we turn to My Father's Song by Simon Ortiz, a member of the Acoma Sovereign Nation.
Wanting to say things, I miss my father tonight. His voice, the slight catch, the depth from his thin chest, the tremble of emotion in something he had just said to his son, his song. We planted corn one spring at Aku. We planted several times, but this one particular time I remember the soft, damp sand in my hand. My father had stopped at one point to show me an overturned furrow. The plowshare had unearthed the burrow nest of a mouse in the soft, moist sand. Very gently, he scooped tiny pink animals into the palm of his hand and told me to touch them. We took them to the edge of the field and put them in the shade of the sand moist clod. I remember the very softness of the cool, warm sand and tiny alive mice and my father saying things.
Sentimental Education is our next selection. In this one, Tony Hoagland remembers his father, who was an Army doctor. Tony Hoagland grew up on Army bases all over the South. He currently teaches at the University of Houston.
Sentimental Education. And when we were 8 or 9, our father took us back into the Alabama woods, found a rotten log, and with his hunting knife, pried off a slab of bark to show the 100 kinds of bugs and grubs that we would have to eat in a time of war. The ones who will survive, he told us, looking at us hard, are the ones who are willing to do anything. Then he popped one of those pale slugs into his mouth and started chewing. And that was lesson number 4 in the Green Beret book of child rearing. I looked at my pale, scrawny, knock-kneed, bug-eyed brother who was identical to me, and saw that in a world that ate the weak, we didn't have a prayer. And the next thing I remember, I'm working for a living at a boring job that I'm afraid of losing, and with a wife whose lack of love for me is like a lack of oxygen, and this dead thing in my chest that used to be my heart. Oh, if he were alive, I would tell him Dad, you were right. I ate a lot of stuff far worse than bugs. And I was eaten. I was eaten. I was picked up and chewed and swallowed down into the belly of the world.
That calls to mind Robert Bly's poem about a certain type of father found in the United States. It's called
The Busy Man Speaks. Not to the mother of solitude will I give myself away. Not to the mother of love, not to the mother of conversation, nor to the mother of art, nor the mother of tears, nor the mother of the ocean. Not to the mother of sorrow, nor the mother of the downcast face, nor the mother of the suffering of death, not to the mother of the night full of crickets, nor the mother of the open fields, nor the mother of Christ. But I will give myself to the Father of righteousness, the Father of cheerfulness, who is also the Father of rocks, who is also the Father of perfect gestures. From the Chase National Bank, an arm of flame has come, and I am drawn to the desert, to the parched places, to the landscape of zeros, and I shall give myself away to the Father of righteousness, the stones of cheerfulness, the steel of money, the Father of rocks.
Cluster Bombs is our next poem. It was written by a young student, Shelley Severin, and it was published in the California Poets in the Schools statewide anthology for 2004-2005.
Cluster Bombs. His legs are gone. Not paralyzed. His legs are gone. Amir is 11. His eyes are gone. Not blind. His eyes are gone. Ollie is 5. Cluster bombs explode when you touch, when you step. Shiny metal cylinders, reddish brown, no bigger than a toy, strewn along streets, playgrounds, buried in garbage heaps. But they are legal, claims American military. Besides, the war in Iraq is over. The children are now free.
Next, a sixth grader's view of life in these United States is titled Violence in the Community and was written by Brittany Washington, a resident of Oakland.
Violence in the community. I walk down the street and what do I see? People on the corner selling that rock, smoking that weed, beating each other. Have you seen all the violence in my community? Gang colors, red and blue. The same age kids just like me and you, smoking drugs. I walk down the street, scared like fright, but I say to myself it will be all right. So if you think you've seen all you can see, just come and see the violence in my community.
We have one more poem by a California youth. I Come From by Jacob of Sonoma County.
I come from rebels, racists, and wrong, drunks, addicts, and average rednecks, mechanics, and poor men's work, shaved heads, mullets, and long hair, plowing, planting, and living off the land, Chevys, trucks, and duck blinds. Dogs, guns, and white trash. I come from fishermen, hunters, and carnivores.
We turn again to Tony Hoagland for his take on the American melting pot. The poem is Food Court, and we're reading it in two voices.
If you want to talk about America, why not just mention Jimmy's Wok and Roll American Chinese Gourmet Emporium? The cloud of steam rising from the bean sprouts and shredded cabbage when oil is sprayed on from a giant plastic bottle wielded by Ramon, Jimmy's main employee who hates having to wear that sanitary hairnet and who thinks that food smells funny. And the secretaries from the law firm drifting in from work at noon to fill the tables of the food court in their cotton skirts and oddly sexy run-in shoes.
Why not mention the little grove of palm trees maintained by the small corporation and the splashing fountain beside it, and the faint smell of dope smoke drifting from the men's room where two boys from the suburbs dropped off by their moms with the baggy ghetto pants and skateboards are getting ready to pronounce their first sentences in African-American?
Oh, yes, everything, all chopped up and stirred together in a big steel pan held over a medium-high blue flame, while Jimmy watches with his practical black eyes.
Food in America, a big subject. Here's an autobiographical story about that by Spokane native Sherman Alexie. It's an excerpt from his poem, Sugartown.
Once when I had not eaten in 24 hours, as I waited for my father to come home from the hunt for money, any money, I prayed for food, for food. Could that happen? In the United States of America? Yes, I prayed for food, and just as I whispered, Amen, my father walked in the door with a large bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Next, we have Affirmative Action by Simon Ortiz.
One 4th of July, my kids and I went to see the parade in Grants. Somebody had told me that the ex-judge had bought the old city jail. Sure enough, I saw that he had turned it into a place called the Jailhouse Restaurant, advertised as a very in place to go in Grants. The new and bigger city jail set at the edge of Martinez Park, and the city hall walls displayed a number of affirmative action signs. I guess that could mean that the jail was now filled with Cajuns, Okies, Mexicans, Blacks, as well as Indians.
In his poem, The Allegory of the Temp Agency, Tony Hoagland takes on the working man's America.
In the painting titled The Allegory of the Temp Agency, the employers are depicted as wolves with blood-red mouths and yellow greedy eyes, pursuing the small business employees through the dark forest of capitalism. It is night, and by the light of the minimum wage moon, we can see the long pink tongues of the bosses hanging out and the dilated white eyeballs of the employees as they flee through the woods, lacking any sense of solidarity or collective organizing power. Upon closer inspection, the leaves beneath their feet are shredded dollar bills which bear the distressed expressions of ex-presidents. And the wind in the trees is making a long howl of no health insurance or job security. And no, it's not really a very good painting. Heavy-handed in concept and comic unintentionally, in a way that invites us to laugh at the desire for justice. Rather, the painting shows that the artist was untalented and is an allegory of how difficult it is to be both skillful and sincere, which in turn explains why the art that hangs in the lobbies of banks and in the boardrooms of corporate office buildings is often made of black and white slashes against a background of melted orange crayon, or glowing lavender rectangles floating in gray haze, works in which no human figures appear, in which the halves do not appear to be chatting and laughing as they eat their sushi, carved from the lives of the have-nots.
Hard Rain is next, our last selection from Tony Hoagland today.
Hard Rain. After I heard It's a Hard Rain's a Gonna Fall, played softly by an accordion quarter through the ceiling speakers at the Springdale Shopping Mall, I understood. There's nothing we can't pluck the stinger from, nothing we can't turn into a soft drink flavor or a t-shirt. Even serenity can become something horrible if you make a commercial about it using smiling white-haired people, quoting Thoreau to sell retirement homes in the Everglades, where the swamp has been drained and bulldozed into a 19-hole golf course with electrified alligator barriers. "You can't keep beating yourself up, Billy," I heard the therapist say on the television to the teenage murderer, "about all those people you killed. You just have to be the best person you can be one day at a time." And everyone in the audience claps and weeps a little because the level of deep feeling has been touched, and they want to believe that the power of forgiveness is greater than the power of consequence or history.
We're going to close with a new story by Simon Ortiz. We're reading it in two voices.
Several years ago, I was a patient at the VA hospital in Fort Lyons, Colorado. I got a message to call this woman, so I called her up. She said to me,
"I'm looking for an Indian. Are you an Indian?"
"Yes," I said.
"Oh, good. I'll explain why I'm looking for an Indian. Every year we put on a parade in town. A Frontiers Day parade. It's exciting and important, and we have a lot of participation."
"Yes," I said.
"And then more recently, we had some people who dressed up as Indians, to make it more authentic, you understand. Real people."
"Yes," I said.
"Well, that didn't seem right. But we had a problem. There was a lack of Indians."
"Yes," I said.
"This year, we wanted to do it right. We have looked hard and high for Indians, but there didn't seem to be any in this part of Colorado."
"Yes," I said.
"We want to make it real, you understand? Put a real Indian on a float. Not just a papier-mâché dummy or an Anglo dressed as an Indian, but a real Indian with feathers and paint. Maybe even a medicine man."
"Yes," I said.
"Then we learned the VA hospital had an Indian here. We were so happy."
"Yes," I said. "There are several of us here."
"Oh, good."
"Well, last spring, I got another message at the college where I worked. I called the woman. She was so happy that I returned her call. And then she explained that Sir Francis Drake, the English pirate, was going to land on the coast of California in June again. And then she said she was looking for Indians." "No," I said. "No." And that's it for Poetry Basket. Our readers were Samuel Claiborne, Carol Goodale, Matthew Metzger, Florine McCovey, Cynthia Poten, Joseph Orozco, and Jay Rinzulli. Poetry Basket was produced by Cynthia Poten and engineered by Joseph Orozco. Thank you for listening.